From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. Electrons to Enlightenment, a special series on science and religion. This hour, the brain and belief.
Gloria in excelsis Deo.
Ashhadu an la
In every language, in every country, in every age of the world, people have raised their voices in prayer. In our time, human faith in the existence of a spiritual reality has taken some hard knocks from Western science. But that could be about to change.
You know, you just have to realize that more people pray every day than have a nervous breakdown or have sex or do almost any of the other things that we study. Spirituality and religion are really an important part of people's life, and I think they're deserving of more study.
In this hour, brain researchers probe the biology of belief, and the hard science of neurology tackles the ethereal world of the spirit. Buddhism has famously been called less a religion than a philosophy of the mind. After all, the heart of Buddhist practice is meditation, the not-so-simple discipline of learning to watch your own mind. So, maybe it's not surprising that some of the country's top neurobiologists are now collaborating with Buddhist monks to see what they can discover about the human mind together. Independent producer Karen Michel prepared this report.
Though I was born in the year of the dog, I often have monkey mind. Monkey mind. When the chatter and clatter, the ring, ring, ringing of the undone, needs done, wishta, coulda, snippets of songs, pains in the butt, wow, cool shoes. That seemingly relentless, unshut upness of the brain, of the mind, that makes you feel like you're going mad. There is a cure. It's free, not so easy, and distinctly non-American. Meditation. It's 7 a.m. at the Garrison Institute, a former Capuchin monastery an hour north of Manhattan. I'm one of nearly 100 people sitting on round cushions and in chairs, meditating. Most have their hands in their lap, one hand over another, palms up. Some straggle in late, making a surprising amount of noise for people in bare feet. We are all silent. That is, we're all silent on the outside, but inwardly, those monkeys are active. I don't know why, but I can't get the sound of Levon Helm and his daughter Amy singing Shake a Hand out of my mind, and it's driving me nuts.
Shake a hand if you can.
Shake a hand if you can.
Like everyone else, I'm at a week-long retreat on the Buddha, the brain, and the science of happiness, presided over by 30-year-old Tibetan Buddhist master Yonggye Mingyur Rinpoche.
Actually, this retreat is like two point of view. One is neuroscience and the Buddhist meditation joined together.
As far as anyone here knows, it's the first time that there's been a retreat like this, where the two seemingly very different approaches to truth have come together.
In terms of the relationship between my meditation practice and my practice as a professional scientist, I find them extraordinarily compatible.
Neuroscientist Richie Davidson and his University of Wisconsin associate Antoine Lutz are here too to give presentations in the evenings about their pioneering work on meditation and the brain. Davidson, a narrow-faced man with curly salt and pepper hair, is both a longtime researcher in the field and an even longer time meditator.
Meditation and science both involve seeing the world more clearly, looking at nature in an unbiased way in certain respects. They both involve a certain discipline and commitment to honesty. And so there are really an extraordinary number of similarities between science and Buddhism, or science and meditation practice.
What Buddhists have known for more than 2,500 years, scientists have only been studying recently. Mingyur Rinpoche has written a book about the interface. Or maybe it's the interfaith.
Actually, I wrote one book, you know, The Joy of Living.
Do you see the book as a manual for happiness?
Manual means?
A guide.
This book is a guide
for
happiness.
How to guide.
Yes, because I put my personal experience in this book. Because these methods are when I having problem, you know, when I was young, and I use these methods. I believe this help a lot. If you practice, I think you can deal with the emotion and the tightness in a problem, I think, easily.
Fortunately, at the retreat, there are many opportunities for practice. We meditate together several times a day and keep silence from after the last teaching until the next afternoon. A few participants sneak in cell phone calls, like teenagers having an illicit smoke in the high school bathroom.
You are doing 5 days retreat here. Most important is you have to keep your mind with balance. What is balance means? Not too tight, not too loose, you know. If your mind too tight, because you think, oh, this is a retreat, you know, and very special, and I have to meditate, you know. If you're too tight, then everything makes more difficult.
Samche namje sampadam loye chegra jita war.
Anyone who says meditation is easy hasn't tried it. For one, especially in the beginning, it can be boring. And for another, it can be painful. Cramps in legs cross too long, pain in the back and behind from sitting on the floor, and there's psychic pain too, as layers of accumulated crap, or karma, get exposed to the breath, to the air, to the mind of the meditator. The glory is that this works, and not just anecdotally. All this sitting around has hardcore, lasting effects. It's been proven that in the long run, meditating can make you happier than, say, winning the lottery. Really. In Richie Davidson's Wisconsin lab, he studied Buddhist monks who've probably never played the lottery, but they have spent tens of thousands of hours meditating.
The range in our study went from about 12,000 to about 62,000 hours of practice.
And he studied people who are new to it, too. Even with 3 months of meditating, 30 minutes a day, the brain shows changes. Increased activity in the left prefrontal cortex, an area of the brain associated with positive emotion, with happiness, compassion, and, if you will, the joy of living. So where are we going?
Downstairs. Let me show you some of our cool techniques.
This is the Dalai Lama's favorite room.
And as well as all the other toys, we have our own machine shop.
It's a workshop with drill presses and power tools. None of the high-end stuff that tests and charts the machinations of the mind. The Dalai Lama hasn't been tested, but his enthusiasm for the endeavor has helped recruit others. Yonge Mingyur Rinpoche has been in the lab twice.
Come on in.
There's a big machine, you know, very big machine. Inside it's very cold. I have to lie down, and you cannot move at all, you know. Sometimes I get itchy, you know, in my face, but I couldn't do anything, just a little bit move. And very a lot of noisy. Then I have to meditate. Then they send a lot of noisy, you know. The children and women scream. Wow! It's a lot of noisy. And baby crying. Oh! It's very, very interesting.
In this environment, Mingyur Rinpoche's results were astonishing, visible without the sophisticated equipment usually necessary to monitor brain activity. The researchers thought their equipment had malfunctioned. I was curious, though not MRI curious, to find out if my several years of meditating would show anything at all, or if I'd be the person who, even with diligent practice, never learned the basic scales.
We are in our EEG room here. We have two parts of the room. We have the control area out here, and then in that booth is where the subject generally sits.
That would be me?
Yes, that would be you.
And what are you going to be doing?
I'm going to be putting on an EEG net today.
I was fitted with what looked like a thick hairnet in iPod white. There were 138 individual sensors that had to contact my scalp. This is a mega EEG.
Next thing we're going to do is stand up and move you into the booth over here. And you can have a seat on the black chair.
Actually, I sat on the floor of the small trapezoidal room, on an appropriately maroon-colored pillow. I was told when to open my eyes, when to close them, when to meditate on an external object, when to meditate on compassion. Normally, this would go on for 45 minutes. My session lasted far less, for it turned out my results weren't going to be tabulated. And I'll never know if I just think that meditating has changed me, or if it physiologically has. And even so, I won't know which kind of meditation produced what response. And that's something this lab very much wants to know.
All of these techniques are going to have a different impact on the brain. So it would be very misguiding not to make the effort to be precise about what you're actually doing and what you're actually studying.
Tall, boyish-looking French neuroscientist Antoine Lutz is Richie Davidson's junior colleague. Like Davidson, he too is a meditator. Rigor is key in their research, he says. Largely because their research has been published in serious peer-reviewed scientific journals, other scientists' accusations of woo-woo are on the wane.
There are important scientific questions that can be developed through this dialogue. And in particular, for instance, to understand the relation between a mental training and brain plasticity. It's also important to understand emotion in general, in particular positive emotions. And finally, meditation can really inform the therapies in the clinical world and maybe help to better tailor a new therapy to help alleviate suffering.
I'm Katie Roth, and I'm a clinical social worker in Providence, Rhode Island. I've been meditating since the late 80s.
I'm Beverly Sarabian. I'm a clinical psychologist in Providence, Rhode Island, and I've been meditating since the late 70s.
Roth and Sarabian were both at the retreat, often asking questions, taking notes. Both women have gray hair. Sarabian's office has images of the Buddha. Roth plays Baroque flute.
There are a number of ways in which I think of meditation is having an influence on my practice. The first is probably just in terms of helping me to be able to stay very present with people. In meditation, you're really training yourself to stay present with whatever arises. And when you're sitting with someone, having this quality of unwavering attention is really, really valuable, helps people feel safe and helps them share with you.
Often they share stories of terrible trauma. Not surprisingly, a number of both women's patients are severely depressed. And that meditation cannot initially cure.
Sometimes there is a need for antidepressants. However, meditation is actually quite efficacious in preventing relapse, and this is particularly true in resistant cases of depression wherein the person has been depressed three or more times.
For years, clinicians have counseled people to meditate to seek relief from pain, emotional and physical. So for the two shrinks from P-Town, science validating Buddhist philosophy is no big whoop.
It's nice to get the confirmation and, you know, the added sophistication and understanding, but none of it came as a surprise, really.
It's great, though, to have the data because it's not simply observational data. I mean, it is observational data, but it's observing a different level of reality than I have access to in my therapy room.
Anicca vata sankara upadvaya domino.
For nearly an entire week, every day and night, I sat behind a brown-robed, shaven-haired Buddhist nun. Ordained in Burma, born in Hawaii, her name now is Viranyani.
All conditioned things arise and pass away. He or she who realizes this knows the deepest happiness, which is peace.
Iti piso bhagava araham samma sambuddho.
The monkey finally stopped scratching at my mind by day three of the retreat. There was an incredible clarity and an eagerness to get up early, to be ready for the daily 7 a.m. meditation. And yes, I felt joy, a joy with none of the bluster of Beethoven's ode, but more the equanimity that comes with what the Buddha taught as the middle way, and a feeling of what's called loving kindness. I plan to stick with the ancient neuroscience of Buddhism. It's kind of a no-brainer.
Now you have to think, okay, all the sentient being, all the sentient being like to have happiness, don't want to have suffering. What is the last stage, which is completely free from suffering, achieve unchangeable happiness? That's the final enlightenment, like Buddha.
Uchipatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Nyayapatipanno Bhagavato.
Karen Michel is an independent producer based in New York. Now, while Richie Davidson and his colleagues are scanning the brains of Buddhist monks, Andrew Newberg is doing the same thing with Franciscan nuns and Pentecostalists. Newberg directs the Center for Spirituality and the Mind at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's curious about the experience of prayer. What happens when people pray? If someone tells you she's felt the presence of God, can you see it on a brain scan? Steve Paulson asked Andrew Newberg what brain imaging technology can tell us.
Well, it certainly can tell us what happens in our brain when we do have an experience that we call religious or spiritual. For example, we've had the opportunity to study Franciscan nuns doing prayer. And during that prayer, the goal of that particular prayer is to try and open themselves to being in God's presence. What our brain scans can ultimately show is what happens in the brain if they have that experience, if they have the experience of being in God's presence. What those scans don't necessarily prove for us is whether or not that experience was real in some sort of objective reality, that God really was in the room, that God really was communicating through them or communicating with them.
Well, tell me about this study that you did with the Franciscan monks, and we can also mention the studies you've done with Tibetan Buddhists as well, and we should point out that these are people who have, for the nuns, they have prayed for many years. The Buddhists have meditated for many years, so they were very experienced doing this. But what did they do in your lab?
Well, what we found with the Franciscan nuns was that they activated several important parts of the brain. One of the parts of the brain that they activated during the prayer was the frontal lobe. And the frontal lobe has been an area of the brain that I've been particularly interested in over the years because it tends to be activated whenever we focus our mind on something. And this can be very mundane. It can be focusing on our driving directions or focusing on a problem we're trying to solve at work. Or it can be focusing on a prayer or a phrase from the Bible, which is what was happening with the Franciscan nuns. So they would take a particular prayer of great meaning to them, and they would focus their attention, focus their mind on it. And as they continued to do this and try to bring their full attention to that particular prayer, they would begin to feel a lot of unusual experiences. They would begin to lose their sense of self. They would feel that they become kind of absorbed into the prayer itself. And another part of the brain that was different in the prayer state is in a part of the brain called the parietal lobe. And this is a part of the brain that normally takes our sensory information and tries to create for us a sense of ourself and try to relate that self spatially to the rest of the world. So it's that part of our brain that when we get up out of our chair and walk out the door that enables us to do all that. What we've hypothesized is that when people meditate or pray, they begin to block the sensory information that gets into that area, and we think that that may be ultimately associated with an experience where they lose that sense of orientation, where they lose that sense of self, and they feel that they become one with something greater.
You also did a very intriguing study of some Pentecostal Christians who speak in tongues.
Right.
Can you tell me what happened when you hooked them up to your brain imaging technology?
What we found actually were some very unique differences that really differentiated speaking in tongues from any of the meditation states that we had seen. Hmm. One of the most intriguing differences was that we saw an actual decrease of activity in the frontal lobes. So they are not really focusing their attention on the practice of speaking in tongues. They actually kind of lose their attention. They feel that they are no longer in control of what's happening to them. And we think that that may be associated with this drop of activity in the frontal lobes.
And one thing you said about the Franciscan nuns is when they prayed, they activated the language part of their brain. Was that true with the people speaking in tongues as well?
That's a good question. And actually, we did not observe that in the speaking in tongues. And that also is intriguing because if any of the listeners have heard speaking in tongues, it sounds like the person is speaking a language, but it's not comprehensible. And when people have done linguistic analyses of speaking in tongues, it doesn't correspond to any clear kind of linguistic structure. And I think that that's interesting because we did not see activity in the language areas of the brain. So wherever these different experiences are coming from and these vocalizations are coming from, if they're coming from someplace in the brain, it seems to be coming from areas that are not particularly associated with language. And of course, if somebody is a deep believer in speaking in tongues, the source of the vocalizations is very clear. It's coming from outside the person. It's coming through the Spirit of God.
You know, there's a fundamental mystery in all of this research that you've been describing. A religious person might call a mystical vision a gift from heaven, while a neuroscientist would just say it's an electrochemical surge firing in the temporal right. lobes. Is there any way to resolve this question?
Well, I think that there ultimately is. One of the things that I've been advocating for is that we really need to look not just at what science has to say, but what the subjective nature of these experiences are, what the spiritual side has to say. What we have to be careful about, I think, is saying that because we capture something in the brain that is associated with these experiences, that that explains away those experiences. I don't think we can do that. And I think the more we understand what the feelings that people have when they have those experiences and how they relate to the biology itself, we're going to get closer to answering that kind of question. I don't know exactly what the balance that needs to be struck is, but I think that we really need to look at both the spiritual perspective and the scientific perspective and see where they can help us understand what these experiences and what reality ultimately is all about.
Andrew Neuberg directs the Center for Spirituality and the Mind at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book is called Why We Believe What We Believe. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Did you know that 100 years ago, some of the world's most eminent scientists tried to find proof of life after death?
They were hiding in closets and creeping around under tables and hunting down ghosts. They really had a very exciting life for scientists.
Later this hour, the story of William James and his fellow ghost hunters. I'm Jim Fleming. You're listening to The Brain and Belief, part of Electrons to Enlightenment, a special series on science and religion. Brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
I knew it was a God when he blessed me to be raised by my grandmother, and she taught me about God. So I'm blessed to know that there is a God.
I guess I probably already knew there was a God, but first time I experienced it all was a funeral.
I never felt there was a God. I was a non-practicing Jew from a family of non-practicing Jews, but my parents, like a lot of parents, decided that they thought that we should experience what religion is about. So they took us to synagogue and we had Sunday school, and I remember sitting there and saying, "What a crock." I was maybe 8 years old.
First memory of a God. I can't say I have memories of God.
I was going through a serious crisis, and I was driving along one morning, and a voice, no joke, like right out of where the rearview mirror is, was saying, "No, this is not a mistake." And I thought, hit me with lightning. I am so ticked at what you are putting me through. And I said, "Then this is a joke, and I don't think it's very funny." And he said, "This isn't a joke. It's a compliment.
I remember going there and not really believing what they were saying because there was nothing factual that they, you know, were throwing out there. This book told us some stuff, so we believe it. I don't like reading, so that book really wasn't that great to me.
My first memory of there not being a god was when my stepmom died.
When my parents probably dunked me in the pond. When I was a baby to turn me from a non-Jewish girl to a Jewish girl.
Whether you believe in a god, a goddess, or nothing at all, you still believe. You could say that humans are, by nature, believers. We're the species that constructs mental models of the world, that speculates on the hows and whys and whens of existence. Molecular biologist Dean Hamer says, we can't help it. We're hardwired for belief.
Humans are genetically predisposed to have spiritual instincts. And in our case, we call those instincts a reaching out for God. People in other cultures may call it something else. But I do believe that humans have a natural and innate tendency to reach out beyond themselves.
Dean Hamer runs a biochemistry lab at the National Cancer Institute. But on his own time, he investigates the genetic basis of spiritual belief. Recently, he and his fellow researchers found what the media promptly dubbed the God gene. Steve Paulson asked Hamer to explain what exactly he discovered.
It has been shown for several years that there is a genetic component to spirituality, which we measure as self-transcendence. But we've actually carried that a step further and found at least one specific gene that seems to be involved in this human trait.
What does that gene do?
That gene handles a type of brain chemical that are called monoamines, and these are brain chemicals that are very much involved in the way we feel the universe around us. They're involved in our sense of consciousness, and we think that it's really changes in consciousness that are at the very heart and core of spirituality. So when you look at the spiritual experiences, for example, of Jesus in the desert or of Muhammad in his dreams, they always involve changes in consciousness, a sort of different perception of the universe. And these brain chemicals are involved in exactly that.
You're talking about that sense of universality, of oneness with everything around you?
Exactly. We're talking about the feeling that everything is connected, that you yourself are connected to everything else in the universe, that somehow everything comes together. And it's really quite remarkable how that sort of sensation permeates all of the great religions. It was very true for Buddha. It was very true for the great Christians. It was true for the Jews as well. So I think that really is a universal sense of spirituality.
Now, when you say there's a gene that triggers this change in consciousness, what does that mean?
Well, it simply means that this is one of many different genes that are involved in the metabolism or the handling in the brain of these chemicals that ultimately lead to changes in the sense of consciousness. So it's not like there's a gene for God. Rather, there's a gene that influences the chemistry of the brain, which in turn influences our feelings of spirituality. Everybody has this gene. It's not something that's unique to some people and not found in others, but different people have slightly different versions of the gene so that some people may naturally be more spiritual than are others.
And you're not talking about religion here. I mean, this really has nothing to do with whether we're brought up in a church or not.
Absolutely. One of the most important distinctions, I believe, is between the feelings of spirituality and actual religiousness, that is, being a good Christian or a good Jew or a good Muslim. And in fact, the psychologist Abraham Maslow, who developed the whole idea of this spiritual scale half a decade ago, was himself a very devout atheist. His father had been a rabbi. He was very much against the church, against organized Judaism. And one of his proudest accomplishments was that when he gave his little spirituality test to various people, he claimed that the people that scored the lowest were a priest and rabbis and ministers. So that certainly is a distinction between being religious and being spiritual.
How do you explain that?
Oh, I don't know if it was completely accurate data or just Abraham.
He was twisting the knife a little bit.
Father. I think some people would say that people often get into organized religion because of their interest in the sort of bureaucracy and the laws and the regulation and the authoritarianism, which is very characteristic of organized religion, rather than that sort of all-encompassing connectedness, which is more characteristic of spirituality.
Now, whenever we talk about our genetic makeup, we're talking about how our body evolved this way. How do you explain this from an evolutionary perspective? Why would natural selection favor spiritual belief?
Well, of course, this is a very difficult question because we can't go back and replay the evolutionary tape. So the best that we can do are to make hypotheses. And our hypothesis is that spirituality is selected for because it improves people's psychological health and their physical health. You can understand how the feeling that there's something out there helping us would make people more optimistic and willing to go on. There's also now quite good evidence from large longitudinal studies that a sense of belief and being spiritual or religious actually helps people's physical health, helps people to survive for a longer period and to get over diseases more rapidly. So we think that that type of benefit to people's health would, of course, prolong their lives and improve their reproductive success and would be an evolutionary advantage.
Do you believe in God?
I'm a big believer in the power of belief. And it was quite interesting. When I started working on this book 5 or 6 years ago, I was sort of a typical scientist. That is essentially an atheist. I didn't really believe in any of this stuff. It couldn't be proven to me. It seemed kind of ridiculous to me in some senses. But as I worked on the book, I took it upon myself to do some religious experimentation and to attend various types of religious services and get involved in various types of religious practices. And I found that when I got involved in Buddhism in particular, in Zen, and started meditating a little bit, that it was really quite miraculous, I have to say. You know, that it's actually possible to change your sense of consciousness and your connection to things by just sitting on the floor and not thinking, essentially. You know, to me, the most interesting thing about being alive is that we just sort of go through our lives and we see the world around us and we just assume that's the way the world is, the way we're seeing it. But it doesn't take much more than a little bit of meditation to realize that things aren't always exactly as they seem and that we may be living our whole life in one particular way when things really are actually different than that. And that's a very profound sort of revelation. I think that's really at the heart of the power and the appeal of spirituality to humans throughout the times and throughout the universe.
Dean Hamer is a molecular biologist at the National Cancer Institute and the author of The God Gene. He spoke with Steve Paulson.
Call angels, walk me through this world. Don't leave.
I'm Jim Fleming. You're listening to The Brain and Belief, part of Electrons to Enlightenment, a special series on science and religion, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. You can see psychics and mediums and channelers on TV just about any day of the week. They're fun to watch, but it's hard to know whether to believe any of them. Skeptics say it's all made up, and a lot of it probably is. But could there be a kernel of truth in there somewhere? 100 years ago, a small group of elite scholars and scientists set out to investigate the supernatural. Their scientific credentials were impeccable. There was the world-renowned psychiatrist William James, 2 Nobel laureates, several university presidents. It was the last time scientists of this stature took the paranormal seriously. Science writer Deborah Blum tells the story in her book Ghost Hunters. She told Anne Strangechamps that back then, just as today, psychics and mediums were big business.
People would go to mediums and psychics. There was a hugely thriving trade. Shops, medium shops, and they would hang out their psychic shingle, as it were. You know, people would make appointments or they would have mediums and psychics into their house for their more personal seances. But when you read it, you go, boy, these people desperately needed to believe. And then some of it, and especially with the people I were looking at, they did their best to say, what are all the different ways we can kind of box this up and rule out cheating? And
because there was a lot of hucksterism at the time, wasn't it? I mean, there were, you know, people who said they can produce ectoplasm and people who said they could fly through the air and appeared to, but with using parlor tricks.
Yeah, you know, I saw a really good recipe for ectoplasm involving egg whites. So like, ew. And I have to say, just as someone who likes the history of science, I thought this was one of the best periods in science. I mean, these scientists, they were hiding in closets and creeping around under tables. And I mean, they really had a very exciting life for scientists in the middle of this. And most of it was fraudulent.
Did they find anything that in the end they thought was genuine?
Yes. And in a way that still to this day, I'm not sure how you improve on what they did in some ways. I mean, that's the other thing that looking back I was sort of frustrated by, is you can look at this moment where you have really brilliant people studying this. They had some fascinating ideas about how it might work. And I've wondered sometimes if you took people that smart and with the abilities we have now, I mean, really a concerted effort and looked at the problem again instead of, you know, rolling your eyes and just thinking it's not worth looking at, then maybe we could sort out a little of this. So to give you a idea of that, one of the things they looked at was, why would ghosts wear clothes? I just love
that. That's a good practical question.
That's my favorite, one of my favorites, the problem of the ghost of clothes, because if you believe that a ghost is some kind of energy generated by a person in crisis or a person at the moment of death, if you believe there's some kind of energy involved, or if you believe that it's a spirit, clothes don't have spirits, right? So why in the world would people say that they saw clothed ghosts? And that, to me, is an example of a really interesting question.
Well, it is, but how is it remotely scientifically testable?
That's another really interesting question. How would you get at that? And so one of the things they looked at is they classed these kind of visions in telepathy. And they said, here's your problem, right? It's an information transfer. Of course it's not clothed, right? But it's, let's just say, for instance, that it's an energy transformation from someone that you knew. Then you're the receiver. You put the clothes on the ghost.
Tell me about one or two of the cases that they finally said, okay, maybe this person's genuine.
There was a really good and in her day quite famous medium named Leonora Piper, who was discovered by William James, actually, or at least made famous by William James. And she had a really, even when you read this stuff, you know, from many, many years ago, you go, how did she know that? She had an uncanny ability. And one of my favorite cases involved another professor at Harvard. He worked with James. He did not believe, but Mrs. Piper had gotten so much publicity, he decided to go visit her. And he made an appointment anonymously, came there, determined to reveal no information. And this is all recorded in a letter he wrote to James afterwards. And he said, so I went in, sat down, said 2 words, and she talked for 45 minutes about personal things that she couldn't have known, that I'm not going to tell you because they're too private. And then he told James about this weird experiment he had conducted in which he and his mother had exchanged rings, and he had put in his mother's ring the first word of his favorite proverb, and his mother had put in his ring the first word of her favorite proverb, and he had lost that ring, the ring she gave him. But she had died about 5 years previously, and he had gotten back the ring he gave her. So he had the ring that had the first word of his favorite proverb, and he took it with him. And he held it in his hand, and he said to her, "I'm holding this ring, and I want you to tell me the word that's inside Mother's ring." And she immediately told him the word in the lost ring. Not the ring he was actually holding, but the other one. And he said, "I just don't understand how she did that." And I've turned that over and over in my head, and I don't understand how she did it either. You know, it's like, huh. And I love those huh moments. Yeah. To me, they're what makes the story so interesting. And they allow you to say, there's a reason why these really well-known scientists stuck with this their whole life, because they got close enough or saw just enough to make them say, no, there's something here. We just can't quite figure out what's here, but we know it's a real something.
One of the things I don't understand about this is that, I mean, about this subject, is that since that time, we've come up with quantum physics, quantum mechanics, which has become mainstream theory, which asks us to believe all kinds of much weirder things. You know, the idea that particles can be in two places at once. If we can accept something as weird and strange as quantum theory, why can't we begin to accept the idea that there may be telepathy, there may be other forms of energy?
See, I think that goes back to that power struggle for science and religion. What's real and who gets to tell you what's real? And in this period where my guys, I always think of them as my guys, were trying to sort of lay down this path of evidence or this edifice that people could build on, one of the things that waylaid them was that the science of the time was very determined to get rid of old superstitious ideas and also to tame religious beliefs. You got scientific leaders making statements saying, you know, we're the dominant worldview now, and we're telling religious leaders to step aside because science defines everything. And I think that we still basically fight that fight. But I think that one of the victims of that fight is anything that can't be measured by scientific methodology, right? Mm-hmm. Is you have to question whether or not it's real. If it can't be proven, measured, quantified, tested, replicated, then we have no way as scientists of telling you it's real.
Well, it's interesting to note that a recent review of your book in the New York Times Book Review said that more than a century of psychical research has added nothing to the sum of human knowledge. There is today no more reason to believe in spiritualism or telepathy than there was in the Victorian era.
Yeah, it's been fringy over the last decade. One of the things.
But do you think that's true?
That it's added nothing?
That it's added nothing, no. And that there's no more reason to believe in any of this stuff today than.
I don't believe that. I don't believe it because there are so many interesting unanswered questions that arose then that I think are still valid today. I don't believe it because, and this has been a curious thing for me, since I started working on this book, people have come up and talked to me about different experiences that they've had in a constant and steady flow, and they form a really interesting pattern of experience. And I tend to believe, with William James, that the pattern is trying to tell us something if we would listen to it.
What do you think it's trying to tell us?
I don't have a clue. I think that the pattern is trying to say to us, you don't know everything yet, right? I think it's hubris to dismiss all of those experiences which are occurring today and 100 years ago and say, you know, throughout our history, we've been delusional in this one aspect. I think that there's something there that we just haven't figured out. And I do think that asking questions about those things we can't explain is incredibly valuable. It leads us in all kinds of interesting directions that I would hate for us to not explore because we thought we were too smart to do so.
Science writer Deborah Blum talking with Anne Strangechamps. Blum's new book is called Ghost Hunters, William James and the Search for Scientific Proof of Life After Death. For a serious scientist, investigating the paranormal is, well, maybe not professional suicide, but close. Still, at a few universities around the country, there are some stalwarts who are trying, rigorously, methodically, and using all the technology at their disposal, to answer some very unorthodox questions. Like, can consciousness survive death? University of Virginia psychiatrist Bruce Grayson is considered the father of near-death experience research. For more than 25 years, he's been conducting studies on near-death experiences. So, does he think there's a scientific explanation for them?
Actually, Jim, I approach them with the assumption that there is some scientific explanation for this, and it's been frustrating to find that I can't tell what it is.
Now, one of the articles that I read about this suggested that, I think it was in Switzerland, they found that there was a particular spot in the brain that could be stimulated and would reproduce at least some of the experiences that people were describing as near-death experiences. Isn't that right?
Yes, this was Olaf Blanke's group that studied patients with seizure disorders who, when a certain spot in the brain was stimulated, had a sensation as if they were leaving the physical body. But people who have that experience do not say that they really did leave their body. They speak as if I am leaving their body. And in fact, there are many other things that happen when you stimulate these parts of the brain that have nothing to do with near-death experiences.
But you have, in fact, set up at least one experiment that I read about, which would, you hope, give you some information about this out-of-body experience anyway, yes?
That's right. We have a procedure in which people have automatic defibrillators implanted in their chests. These are people who are having sudden death episodes repeatedly, and these devices are put in their chests to monitor the heart rate, and if they go into some cardiac arrest, it will automatically shock them out of it. And when they implant these devices, the only way to test whether it works is to intentionally induce a cardiac arrest. That gives us sort of a laboratory to study whether these people will have near-death experiences during that period.
So you have this procedure being done. You know that they are going to be clinically dead for a few seconds anyway. How do you work with that then to examine what happens to them?
Well, one of the things that we are doing is we're planting hidden targets in the room in locations that can only be seen, for example, looking down from the ceiling. So if people claim to us that during the procedure they left their bodies and were looking down, we can ask them what they saw. And if they describe this unusual target, then that'll be some pretty impressive evidence. If they don't, then that's maybe evidence that they really didn't leave their bodies.
Yeah. There has been a fair amount of description, I gather, from people who very accurately describe what's happening, but of course you don't know whether they've just seen it happen to somebody else on television.
Well, in fact, there have been a lot of reports that are hard to explain. Sometimes they describe very bizarre, unusual things. For example, one person that I knew described during open-heart surgery looking down on his body and seeing the head cardiac surgeon flapping his wings as if trying to fly. And he described the surgeon putting his hands under his armpits and flapping his elbows. Now, I've been a doctor for 30 years, and I've never seen a surgeon do this. So I did actually interview the surgeon, and he got very upset and said, "Who told you I was doing that?" And I explained to him where I heard it. And he explained to me that, in fact, he had come into the room and had not scrubbed in yet, so his hands were not yet sterile. He was watching his assistants do the operation. So he put his hands under his armpits where he knew they wouldn't touch anything. And he started directing them by waving his elbows around, telling them where to make certain incisions and where to pull different things back. So he essentially confirmed everything that the patient said he had done.
Yeah.
And it's hard to understand how the patient could have guessed that that would have happened.
Now, when you set these targets up in the operating room, and you know that the people are going to have near-death experiences, you interview them after the procedure is done to find out?
Yes. In fact, one of the advantages of a procedure like this, where you know when they're going to have the cardiac arrest, is that you can interview them before the procedure as well as after. So by interviewing them before the experience, we can tell whether their attitudes and beliefs and values have changed as a result of the NDE.
And what is your experience?
Well, I can't tell you about this study because it's still ongoing, but I can tell you that in other studies, that those who have had an NDE tend to be a lot more altruistic, a lot more spiritual, a lot more concerned with relationships and less concerned with things like material possessions, power, prestige. They tend to come back with a sense that we're all in this together.
What's the most extreme example of that that you've personally known of?
Well, I could tell you lots of stories about people who were in violent professions such as police or the military who couldn't go back to that. Probably the most striking is someone who was a bagman for the mafia who was shot in the chest and left on the street for dead. And he had a fairly profound near-death experience, and when he came out of that, he didn't see that life he had been living as being meaningful at all and ended up leaving his career, and he now makes his living counseling spouse abusers. I also had the opportunity to talk to his ex-girlfriend, who complained to me bitterly that he no longer cared about what she called things of substance, meaning money and cars and jewelry.
Do you think that what you've learned about people from their near-death experiences tells us anything scientifically? Does it tell us what we need to know about human consciousness?
I think that near-death experiences really raise a lot of questions about our usual models of the mind and the brain, about consciousness and brain processes. You know, our usual way of thinking about things is the mind is what the brain does. And that seems to be true for the most part for our everyday life. But when you look at extreme circumstances like near-death experiences, there seems to be some disconnection between the mind and the brain. And this has to make us question our models about mind and brain interaction. There's been a model around for at least 100 years that the brain is a filter in some way for thoughts, not a producer of it. And that, in fact, when the brain is impaired, our thinking, in fact, can come through even clearer. We need to be very careful about what we infer from that link. That does not necessarily prove that the mind can continue to function after the person is dead. It does not necessarily imply that the person will live forever, that there is some immortal part of us. But I think it does make us question whether the brain is the generator of the mind rather than the receiver of it, and whether we are really missing something in the whole picture.
Bruce Grayson is the director of the Division of Perceptual Studies at the University of Virginia, and he's the editor of the Journal of Near-Death Studies. I'm Jim Fleming. You've been listening to The Brain and Belief, Part 3 of Electrons to Enlightenment, a special series on science and religion. The series was produced by To the Best of Our Knowledge at the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. For more information on To the Best of Our Knowledge or this series, visit our website at ttbook.org/God.
PRI, Public Radio International.